So we move on to our next topic now, which is the Green Belt, and the question from Bella Duff. Bella asks, Bella's a first-time voter, and she asks, how do you strike a balance between protecting Green Belt land while also satisfying high house building demand? And another question on this topic from Belinda Walsh. I would like to learn more about each party's house building and planning policies, and if any of them can guarantee the Green Belt around St Albans can be protected. Sophia.
Sure, thank you. Everyone deserves a home. Everyone deserves a secure home. And actually, our objective should be to deliver a safe, secure home with high standards of sustainability for everybody. One of the things that we've committed to in the manifesto is building 1.5 million homes. And some people gasp at that and think, well, there goes my green belt. There goes the field that I look out onto outside of my bedroom window. But we've also, alongside that, locked in a commitment that development will benefit communities and nature, and that we will, wherever possible, build in brownfield first and then grey belt, the low grade land. And if that isn't feasible and the infrastructure doesn't allow for communities to be expanded, actually to commit, which we have in the manifesto, to building new towns so that cities like St Albans don't feel entirely choked. It's really important that we understand that the two can be delivered side by side. I was talking to a teacher in one of our local schools yesterday. He found out that one of his Year 7 students is living in temporary accommodation in an industrial estate in Britain in 2024. That is shocking and it is wrong. But it's equally important and it is absolutely possible with the right government in Number 10, which is committed to the environment, to deliver environmentally sound development so that we can give people the homes that they deserve.
Thanks, Sophia. Daisy.
Bella, we have a completely broken planning system. And at the moment, all of the power is in the hands of the big developers. And almost none of the power is in our local communities. And what that means is the planning system doesn't deliver the homes that we desperately need so that young people and young families can stay in the local area. But developers do build these incredibly big executive homes, which quite frankly bring more people to our area because they love St Albans, they want to be here, but it doesn't tackle our housing crisis and it does mean the developers can destroy the green belt. So fundamentally what we need to do is we need to tackle the affordability crisis in housing. We do need to build across the country 150,000 social homes every single year. That's a commitment that we have made that's been welcomed by Shelter and others. But here in St Albans, we do have a lot of overcrowding in our social homes. And so we need to have more social homes, but we need to have a community-led planning system so that our community can say, right, we want these kind of homes, but we want them in these places, we don't want them in those places. And at the moment, our local authority and our communities have very little power. So what we would do is we'd have a bottom-up approach to working out what homes we actually need, and that starts with looking at housing need, not housing demand. Then we start putting proper powers in place so that we do get a brownfield approach. Every political party says they want to build on the brownfield, but I tabled amendments in Parliament to force developers to build on their brownfield sites, and if they didn't, then the local authority could buy that land, and the government rejected it. And when it comes to the Green Belt, we can protect our Green Belt, and I've tabled numerous amendments and challenged the government several times in Parliament to do that. They always promise they're going to do it, but then they never actually do.
Thank you. James.
So I said that, yes, young people need housing, but young people also need a bit of countryside left as well. And as someone who was born in Coney Heath on the Heath, and then moved to Jersey Farm, and then had all them surrounded by Greenbelt my whole life, I don't want that to go for our next generation. And that's one of the key drivers for me in this campaign, one of the key drivers that motivated me to run for St Albans was to protect our Green Belt. Our city's Green Belt is in my DNA, and I am committed to doing all I can to protect it. And so, yes, I completely agree with Daisy. The thing about need and demand are two completely different issues. And at the moment, we just are led by this sort of developer style demand figure, which is in itself quite out of date. We need a really accurate understanding of what the houses we need in St Albans, not those who just want to live here. we talk about building on brownfield. Yes, there is capacity in our 20 biggest cities to have additional density. There is capacity there to build on the surrounding sort of scrubland, as it were. But St Albans isn't like that. So we've got to think of that as well. Very quickly, I will publicly fight against every Greenbelt application in St Albans. As I said, I was a former chair of planning for Westminster City Council. I helped draw up Westminster City Council's draft local plan, which we got through.
Sorry. Thank you very much. Simon.
Well, the Conservatives and Labour people have said very nice, warm words, but unfortunately they're both from parties that not only set up the planning system that we've got now, which is incredibly centralised, but both said they're going to loosen up the planning system, take power, even more power away from local authorities. In the 13 years since I've been a councillor, I've seen that power taken away, and they both promised that they're going to do even more. So he might stand up and protest against the Greenbelt, but his government is making it possible for that to happen. On the other side of the coin is the housing, okay? There are a million empty homes in the UK. We need tax rules to bring those back into use. There are huge, huge numbers of under-occupied homes. Things like stamp duty make it really difficult for people who want to move or want to downsize to do so. We need to look at that, freeing up that housing space. And what houses do we build? We need houses. Here comes the climate bit. We need houses that are fit to live in and that are cheaper to heat, cheaper to run, but also are protected against the heat that is coming, so they are protected against overheating as well. We would put £29 billion over the next 5 years into insulating homes, a street-by-street process run by local authorities with funding from local government to make sure that each home is up to a B standard of insulation. That will save so much money that can be ploughed back in. It's really not rocket science, but yet no other party is coming anywhere close to that in terms of how it would attract, how it would deal with this so-called housing crisis that we have.
And we're on to sewage now. Not a laughing matter, really. Tim Hill.
Thank you. If elected, what would you do to improve the poor state of our globally rare but beleaguered chalk streams, such as the River Ver? And what have you personally done to date?
And an associated question from Martin Strivens.
What are your policies for removing sewage from our rivers?
And one more from Jeremy Silverstone.
Thank you. In a civilised country, should raw, untreated sewage ever be allowed to be pumped into our rivers and seas?
Well, I'm going to ask Daisy to go first on this one, please.
No, it shouldn't. It absolutely, flipping well shouldn't. It's a real scandal, isn't it? I mean, it's a real environmental catastrophe, and it is a catastrophe wherever it's happening, in rivers and streams and on our beaches, but particularly in our chalk streams, which are so rare and so precious. So let me try and answer all of those questions. So what have I done personally? Well, some of you might have seen me standing in that enormous bath that we had outside the museum a couple of years ago to promote a water-saving scheme that we had in St Albans. And as a result of that, we had more people in St Albans than any other local authority sign up to actually try and preserve water from over-extraction, because that's one of the issues that we have locally. I've met with Affinity Water and the Environment Agency. In fact, I demanded that they turned up to a meeting to look at protection of the River Ver and the banks and some of the wildlife that we have at different stretches. In Parliament, I have voted repeatedly in favour of strengthening targets for big water companies. My party and I have called for a sewage tax so that the water companies themselves pay to clean up the rivers rather than putting up our water bills. We've called for a ban on bonuses, and we voted for that in Parliament. We put down an amendment to try and scrap Ofwat and replace it with a regulator with real teeth. We've tabled motions to restructure water companies so that they're no longer just taking away, basically asset stripping is effectively what water companies are doing. We tabled amendments and bills in Parliament to change the structure so they become social benefit companies, so they are forced by law to put environmental principles ahead of profit. We've been campaigning on this for 2 or 3 years. I'm absolutely committed to protecting the River Ver. I'll do absolutely everything I can to tackle this issue.
Jake.
It is an absolute disgrace that raw sewage is going into rivers. And when the Conservatives came in 2010, only 7%, I think around that figure, of storm overflows were being monitored. Now it's 100% of all storm overflows are being monitored. The only reason we now know that this absolute catastrophe is happening is because we put measures in place to try and monitor it in the first place. And as a result of that, we are doing, the government has put through the Landmark Environment Act, which is forcing water companies through fines to invest a record $60 billion into our sewage system. Now, I think we've got to be completely honest about the state of, or the reason why this is happening. The reason why this is happening is because we have a largely Victorian sewage system where rainwater and human waste goes in the same pipes. When we have exacerbated rainfall, it's either being discharged into rivers or it's coming up through people's loos and bathtubs. And I had this, and you were talking about personal experience of dealing with this issue. When I was cabinet member for city management in Westminster, I dealt with the Maid of Elle floods, where we had that exact problem of a super cyclone rainfall event, which caused a complete overflow and broken stopcocks and non-return valves, meaning that water was coming back up through people's loos. And I held Thames Water to account over that and got them to actually admit that they were in the wrong and they needed to install non-return valves in people. So,
Simon.
Yes, you might have seen in the news, I think today there's a new report that says Hertfordshire has the dirtiest rivers in the country. It's absolutely disgraceful. You know, we're not even by the sea, we're not having it pouring out into the sea, and yet that's the statistics. So it's clearly not working. Personally, I mean, I've organised petitions, I've spoken to Affinity, I've created local publicity about the River Verne, abstraction from that. I've met with a former chief executive of a water company who explained to me just how these water companies run rings around the regulator. They're just laughing all the way to the bank. So one of the things the Green Party would do would be immediately bring back into public hands all the private water companies. And that money that is currently being extracted, or abstracted if you like, for profits for shareholders can be used to fix the leaks. You know, Affinity made £35 million extra profit a year ago, and yet 18% of the water in their pipes leaks out. And do you know why? Because it's cheaper for them not to fix it. Then water is essentially a free resource for them. This is why privatised national utilities are so crazy, because it just is literally coming from the sky and someone's going to make money out of that. Is that a good system? Clearly it isn't. So that's the first thing we would do. We'd increase budget for DEFRA and the appallingly under-resourced Environment Agency, which comes in for so much slack. They're terrible, but it's because they're completely underfunded. The regulators have to be given much more teeth in order to sort this problem out.
Sophia.
One of the reasons why this is happening is not because we've got a creaking Victorian sewage system. We have lots of bits of the UK's infrastructure that was designed in the Victorian era that isn't spewing out foul excrement on the streets. It's ethics, it's business ethics, and it's regulatory ineffectiveness. The way to solve this actually is to put in place effective regulatory measures, hold companies to account, and change the nature of business. Change the expectations of what company directors are there to do and how we hold them to account. In our manifesto, some of the commitments we make, which I think are worth spelling out here, mandatory monitoring, automatic fines, no more running round circles around the regulator, legally binding targets, the ability to strike off company directors, and the ability to put water companies into special measures when they fail, and having a regulatory system as a whole that can actually hold them to account. So the question as to what I personally have done, I'm not an environmentalist by trade, but what I am is actually a regulator. What I've spent my life doing is thinking about how we use the regulatory frameworks, both ex post and ex ante, to drive the sort of behaviours that we want out of corporate entities, particularly if they're delivering utilities. One of the projects that I was involved in early doors was something called the Future of the Corporation, which is asking the very basic question, which is what is a corporation there for in society? Some people hide behind the Companies Act that says directors' duties are for their shareholders only. Actually, maybe not. Maybe they should be for stakeholders. Maybe they should be for society.
Thank you. And we're on to transport now, and the question comes from Mike Yorworth.
What are your plans to improve support for cycling, wheeling and walking and reduce the reliance on the car?
And a related question from Diane Page. What are their thoughts on ways of reducing congestion in St Albans and improving air quality. James.
So, since 2020, the government has increased the amount of funding for active travel. And these, the government spent a record $2.3 billion in improving this across the country. This includes the Active Travel Fund for local authorities and funding for new cycle highways. This has to be done. It has to be done because we need to create a system where the majority of journeys can be done on foot. I think the statistics are around something like 5% of journeys, or no, 75% of journeys are under 5 miles. We can make cities much more connected. In terms of St Albans, I fully support the 20 mile an hour rollout across St Albans. As someone who worked on Westminster City Council in highways, they work. 20 miles an hour systems work because you have you do it on a data-led system, which looks at average road speeds. And if we can create the system where we have slow-moving traffic, which is well monitored, but we still look at where our main arterial roads are and keep those at, say, 30, I think we can have a much more better connected St Albans city centre.
Thank you, James. Simon.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen that the lack of funding, I would say, in cycling and walking here and elsewhere. We've seen the failure of privatised buses. Remember when Chime Square used to be a bus station? We don't have a bus station anymore. It's called the High Street, and it doesn't work. And we've seen the failure of privatised rail. We know it works well for us. Again, we're very lucky here. When Thameslink works, it works brilliantly. But it's incredibly expensive and is a barrier to people going to work and living their lives. And around the country, it's even worse in terms of the quality of the rail that's provided. And for both rail and buses, of course, what they'll do is they'll just run the most profitable lines and ignore the ones that aren't. And that's not how society works. We're supposed to be having a public transport system that looks after the public's needs and gets the public where it wants and needs to go. We don't have that. So, surprise, surprise, we would nationalise the buses and the trains. And particularly on buses, particularly locally, because buses really do only run on the privatised streets. You only see them on a couple of roads in St Albans. And in the old days, well, let's not worry about the old days. In the new days, we can have small electric buses flitting around, kind of Uber style. There's loads and loads of models out there working in lovely old Europe. They're doing it very well in some parts over there. Some parts of England have got trams, probably too small here for that. But if you start that funding, if you renationalise, and so that you can focus that funding on where it's needed rather than where somebody who wants to make money out of it wants it to go, then you will start to get an improved system. And you can also say, do you know what, in this area, we're going to prioritise cycling, we're going to prioritise walking, because we're all cyclists, we're all walkers, we're all drivers, we all take public transport at different times, and so we should be looking after everyone's interests.
Thank you.
Having an integrated transport system that allows people to get out of their cars and use some other mode of transport is probably the most effective way of being able to both clean our air, decongest, is that even a word?
Just now.
Decongest your chest. reduce congestion in our towns and cities. I'm a commuter par excellence. I use the train probably 3 or 4 times a day to go to places that I go to. I hardly ever drive, mainly because I hate it, but also because, frankly, I don't think I should have to drive. In the core of our manifesto, we think the infrastructure of our towns and cities, connectedness, but also within our towns and cities, is absolutely essential. And that's why we make some really big commitments, which are worth mentioning. First of all, an overhaul of our railway. Simon, you mentioned it. We have a commitment to put passengers right at the heart, bringing railways back into public ownership. And before someone says, oh, we're going to go bankrupt, no, we're going to wait until those contracts come to an end. And as they cease, they will come into public ownership and will be run by GB Rail, which will drive investment in day-to-day delivery. On buses, the system needs absolute reform. When I was a kid, I used to get the bus to school every single day through a very complicated city, actually. You have to change twice, but they were cheap, they were accessible, they were there all the time. No one drove their kids to school, and that was up north in a city that was disconnected in many ways. The reforms that we have will be to put buses back into local hands and to allow local authorities to manage them and taking away the ban that currently exists.
Thank you, Sophia. Daisy.
Well, I really love cycling, but boy, is it scary round here. Whether you're in Coney Heath or Smug Oak Lane or like Brickett Woods area, I mean, there are potholes everywhere. And it's really scary as a cyclist to be on those roads when a car's overtaking you and there's a pothole right in front and you genuinely think, is this the moment I'm going to get knocked off my bike? And that's it. So one of the things that we would do is we would review the roads budget and look to stop projects where they want to build new roads and reinvest that money into actually fixing our roads and our cycle routes so that the existing roads and cycle routes are safer. The second thing that's really frustrating, actually, under this government is they have lots of small pots of money and they force local authorities to compete for that little pot of money. And some of the pots of money are so prescriptive. We've had a banana situation with Watson's Walk. Some of you may know that there's plans to put in a cycle route there, where in order to get the money from the Department for Transport, we had to prove that the prescriptive version that they wanted wasn't actually going to work. And that's a really obscene waste of time and effort and money. A much better way of doing it is to pool all the resources from across government departments and then facilitate local authorities to develop networked transport systems so that walking, cycling, buses, trains can all be integrated and networked across our area. And that's what we would want to see. And giving local authorities the specific responsibility to do that. In our case, it would be Hertfordshire County Council. And Hertfordshire County Council actually has the powers to run bus franchising, but they don't have the resources to do so. And I would really fight tooth and nail to make sure we could get more resourcing from government so we can have a proper bus service in Hertfordshire.
And our next topic is food, and the first question comes from Catherine Glock.
British agriculture is in crisis. With that in mind, what are you doing? What are your plans to ensure security of food supply while protecting the environment?
And a related question from Jill Watson.
Do you have concerns about food security and how are you going to tackle this?
Okay, thank you. And we'll start with Simon.
Yes, thanks for the questions. Yeah, I've already mentioned earlier the concerns about food security and how that fits in with all other policy. Of course, it obviously fits in not just with climate policy and reducing our emissions, but also with health. One of the crises that we're probably not going to speak about that much today, but is one of the top things that, of course, has fallen apart in this country. And of course, the food that we eat is a huge part of that. The agricultural community as well is a part of that. And of course, farmers are in a real bind, caught between the kind of mega food suppliers and a sort of culture of cheap food being best, of this kind of last minute food supply, which we saw tremble and nearly break during COVID. This idea that we're only 2 days away from breakdown because if the lorries don't come in with the food piled high from miles and miles away, then suddenly our larders are empty, which is quite a scary thought. So we need to become much more self-sufficient. And one of the things that the Green Party would be looking for is a strategy that actually says we need to grow a greater variety of food and produce a greater variety of the food that we eat in this country. Again, because that's good for food security, it's good for our farmers. We want to encourage farmers, rather than having this kind of monoculture, which works well when the price is up and then works terribly when the price goes down, to have more mixed farming. Moving away from pure meat and dairy farming, for example, moving more into a mixed agriculture environment for farmers generally. We also want to support that by providing free and nutritious school meals for every single child, one a day for every child. That's going to obviously tackle the health issue, but it's also going to help British farmers.
Thanks, Simon. Sophia.
One of the things that we've committed to in the manifesto is publishing a land use framework that consultatively working with all of the stakeholders, farmers, local communities, environmentalists and so on, are able to really understand how we can pull the levers, support people in the best way that we possibly can who are farmers, incentivize the kinds of things, Simon, that you described around diversity of food supply, so that we can balance these multiple tensions in the system around housing, environmental protection, farming and food security, and infrastructure. And that ought not to be something that people just pull the odd pledge out of a hat and say, well, here's a great big banner that we can get under. Actually, they're really complicated trade-offs and there's quite complex decisions to be made. And we need to be working in partnership, a really collaborative approach, because there is a way through this where we can deliver greater food security. One of the things we haven't touched on is animal welfare and standards of both animal products, but also the wider food quality. And one of the things that we've seen, tragically, is the diminution of food standards as we've desperately been trying to strike trade deals here, there and everywhere. And actually, British farming should be a gold standard, and we should protect that for our own good, but also in order to uphold the standards internationally. We've also committed to 30 by 30, so this is a crowd of the converted, you'll know what that means. And that plays a really important role in being able to develop really good crop and yield, because all
Sophie,
of those ecosystems
to bring you
come together.
To
I'm sorry,
thanks.
No. Yeah.
That's all right, no problem. Daisy.
So we have a really obscene situation in this country where food is expensive, some families are going hungry, and yet our farmers are seeing fresh food rotting in their fields. That is obscene. It is so obscene. So we would have an integrated food and farming strategy. That would give security, it would improve food security, it would tackle the price of food, and it would also tackle poverty and improve the nation's health. So the first thing we would do is we would invest £1 billion extra into farming every single year, into the environmental land management system. That would enable farmers to continue to actually own their farms and not have to sell them off. It would enable them to grow local, healthy food. And it would also enable them to protect the environmental contribution of our farms as well. We would renegotiate the botched Brexit deal with the European Union and the terrible trade deals with New Zealand and Australia, which undermine not only our food standards, but also animal welfare and have completely sold out our farmers. We would use the public procurement process, the food that we buy for our hospitals and our schools, to actually buy that healthy, locally grown food that has fewer food miles and is much better in terms of nutrition. And we would make this country a world leader in food standards, and we can do that through all of those measures.
Thank you,
and
Daisy.
Free school meals.
Thank you, Daisy. James.
Yeah, one of the things that really concerns me about farming is the resilience of our soil. We have probably, well, best estimates put about 100 more harvests in some of our prime agri-land. That is really concerning. And one of the ways that we have to turn that around is improving the levels of biodiversity in and around our farms. That does mean protecting our green belt, because a green belt is a very important part of maintaining that sort of regenerative agriculture. But we also need to incentivize and encourage farmers to do more of region agriculture, more countryside stewardship, more long-term landscape planning. Now, controversial opinion, but under the Common Agricultural Policy, 50% of the money that came in, because it was based on land as opposed to what farms were producing, was spent on just 10% of farmers. And that created sort of intensive farming, which has degraded some of our soil quality. So this is why the Conservative government has committed, in the Conservative Manifesto, to that £2.4 billion investment in our farmers, so to create these environmental land managements where farmers are encouraged through the tax system, through government grants, to do regen agriculture, to increase biodiversity, to look at the various things that they can grow on their farm, which is not all about the intensive farming that we've seen for so many years.
Thank you, James.